Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Larry, have you taken the opportunity to look at the history of Christmas, when Christmas was first celebrated, and how it was ultimately integrated into this new Roman religion?
Well, I understand where it was first conceived. It was based on Tammuz birthday, if that's what you're talking about. If you're talking about Christmas or Christ's Mass, so to speak, I know it was outlawed for some years over in Europe because things just got so out of hand, but then they brought it all back. It's such a spotty thing. One of the things I have noticed is that Santa and Satan, the title of the enemy there, share the same letters, don't they? It's very strange.
Same kind of intense costume as well. Although in reality, Satan doesn't dress up in red clothes, and he looks like light.
But that's the thing. He's this red devil burning in hell or over the fires of hell, when in fact he's going to be in the abyss. He's not going to be in charge of anything, you know.
Right. Yeah, the fact is that Christmas was by a different name, but first the birthday of Tammuz. Nimrod, which a name that means sun, was the king of first Babylon, and he died hunting a wild boar. The legend has it, and that's the 40 days that he allegedly suffered or was engaged somehow in this hunting expedition is what weeping for Tammuz is all about. It's the basis of the Christian Lent, and something, by the way, that Yahweh condemns. So what transpired is that his wife, known to some as Semiramis, known as Astarte in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, she wanted to hang on to power. So she had a religious priest impregnate her. And she was impregnated at the vernal equinox, where the sun crosses the constellation of Taurus, the bull, at midday, where days and nights are equal length. It happens to be to coincide with the celebration of the Christmas of the Christian Easter. And she was then impregnated at that time. She made the claim, because it was the equinox, that it was the god, the sun, that impregnated her. So she then became the queen of heaven if she was impregnated by the rays of the sun, which was God. Then she gave birth 9 months later, which if you add 9 months to the vernal equinox, you end up with the winter solstice, which at the time was December 25th. It is now December 22nd, as we've tried to rejigger our calendar from ancient days to modern days. And so 9 months later, on the winter solstice, when the days start growing longer again, the son of the sun was born, which made Semiramis, or Astarte, now known as Mary, the mother of God and the Babylonian religion. And so that is the origin of the festival that Christians celebrate as Christmas. It was then made its way through each of the pagan religions that borrowed from Babylon. You have the birthday of Osiris in the Egyptian religion, the birthday of Dionysus, which is really the model that Christians now use to define and flesh out their Jesus Christ. He's based on Dionysus. And then Bacchus in the Roman religion. It was actually celebrated by the Romans as the Saturnella, which is the celebration of Saturn. The planet was named after the Roman god. It's interesting, too, that when Hadrian was going to rename Jerusalem after himself, and he was going to build two temples on the Temple Mount, one of them was to himself, the other one was to Saturn. the very god that the Saturnella was based on. And it's important to keep in mind what the Romans were doing, because Roman Catholicism, Christianity, was derived entirely from the Roman power, Roman mindset, Roman religion, Roman politics. And so that is its origin. Can you find any reference to Christmas in anything God said?
Well, you can find things that condemn things like Christmas, as an example in Jeremiah, where he's talking about bringing in trees finally decorated and fastening them down and dressing them up with Christmas bulbs on them, basically.
Right.
And he condemns it, and he says never to take part in it. You find that. I mean, he never actually says Xmas, but he certainly does, describe it, and he condemns it.
Yeah, describes the primary tradition of the Christian celebration of Christmas. In fact, he just says don't emulate anything the Gentiles do, and this was an essential part of the Gentile religion. That same passage in Jeremiah also speaks of Astarte and the Astarte pole, which became the Christian cross, and talks about how disgusting that is to him. So the very basis of Easter is also described in that same condemnation. As a matter of fact, Jeremiah is actually written to Gentiles. It begins by saying, I'm writing this to Gentiles. I'm going to use the Jews and their corruption as the example, but I'm writing to you Gentiles. And yet they don't seem to get the picture. You know, my youngest son, we were playing golf yesterday, and he was talking about his New Testament professor. I don't know if he took him for New Testament or Old Testament, but I think he took him for New Testament professor. And was talking about, they were going to take off a Christmas holiday. And my son says, have you ever read the passage in Jeremiah that condemns the Christmas tree? The professor says, we're not going to talk about that in this class.
Didn't want to discuss the fact that Yahweh condemns exactly what's going on. This is so typical, isn't it? I mean,
it
really
is. Yeah, there is no mention of anything Christmas-related in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Yahweh only has seven invitations to meet with him. There's 7 days each year that Yahweh sets apart as times for us to establish our relationship with him. And the first of those dates is Pesach. It's not celebrated on the Christian calendar. The next is Matzah. It is completely ignored by Christianity. It's probably the most important day of the year. And then Bukurim follows, and they've changed Bukurim to Easter. After Esther.
Right there at the end. In Revelation 18:4, he's saying, come out of her, my people. And he's talking about the whore of Babylon. So
exactly.
You don't participate in her sins,
right,
and you don't receive her plagues. That was written more than 500 years after Babylon fell. So what do they think he's talking about?
Yes.
I mean, he's talking about all these Babylonian...
What's most interesting is that if you tie
concept.
That to Daniel, where Yahweh is talking about the four beasts, and he begins with Babylon, and he goes through the four beasts, and the fourth beast is clearly Rome. And then he says that Rome, and he goes into great deal, Rome is a very different beast than the others. And there's no question here, Gabriel talking to Daniel identifies, actually names each of the four beasts. And so when he's talking about Rome, Yahweh says, this is the most despicable, the most vicious, the most conniving beast of all. But then he goes on to say that there's something unique about this beast, that this beast, unlike the others, tramples the entire earth. And that this beast has a revival and continues to the very last day. And so when Yahusha is pleading with his people during the culmination of time on earth, this is at the end of the tribulation, to come out of Babylon, which is the basis of the beast that became Rome, and the continuation of Rome as Roman Catholicism, it's impossible not to see the connection that Yosha is telling people, come out of Christianity. It's Christianity that Yosha is calling his people away from.
You know, one of the interesting things, and you're very familiar with this, is, you know, when they used to worship Baal in the form of a golden calf with the sun between his horns.
Right.
During the vernal equinox.
Yeah.
You know, right there
the bull.
The
bull. The golden calf was a bull.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's when we find the sun in constellation with Taurus the bull on
Correct.
Easter Sunday.
Right.
I mean, come on, guys.
Yeah.
And then 9 months later, the son of the sun is born, Tammuz.
Right.
And, you know, they're putting up all the trees to honor him. Exactly
right.
What Yahweh tells us not to do. Not to participate in these things. The reason these things are deadly is because when you get to the concepts of religion, they're all attached to Yahweh. You know, and there's so many religious myths attached to Yahweh, like he's everywhere. The fact he's omnipresent. Now, I'm going to ask you, Yada, would you like to be associated with the fact that you were everywhere?
No.
All at the same time? How delusional is that?
You know,
a little 7-year-old girl being raped by a serial killer, and you're there.
Right, you're there.
You don't do anything about it, by the way, but you're there.
Right.
I mean,
you lose all identity, and you're exposed to the worst of humanity. No, you think that if Yahweh was everywhere, then he would be in Sheol, then he would be in a black hole, then he would be in darkness. God is unique, and as unique, he cannot be everywhere. The whole concept is ludicrous. The other one is that God is all-knowing. Well, if God's all-knowing, what's the plan of salvation? How does God, who is perfect, know about every dumb thing you and I have done and resolve that if he can't forget it?
You know, nobody wants to see anybody else's worst side.
No.
I mean,
no, especially God. Especially God.
I don't want to see my best friend's worst side. I really don't.
No. No, and then you go to the idea that God is involved in everybody's life, and that everything that happens was God's will. That makes God really perverse, doesn't it?
Makes him a monster, but then all religious deities really are monsters in the end, aren't they?
They are. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Glenn on the line. He's got a comment or an insight on the solstice and what it represents, I would assume, relative to Christianity. Hello, Glenn. Glenn?
Yeah.
Oh, you have a comment on the solstice? We'll have to find out what the issues are with Glenn. There's a reason, Larry, and I think you hinted at this during the last segment, that the Christian holidays are not just wrong, but actually deadly. And that is that somebody who is celebrating them, if you're going to go off and celebrate Christmas, you're going to go off and celebrate Easter, you're going to go to a church and worship on Sunday, that if you're doing those things, you're still associated with Babylon. You're still associated with religion. And what's the first requirement for the covenant? The first requirement for the covenant is to walk away from religion. So if you're still involved in a religion, then you can't participate in the covenant. And if you're not part of the covenant, then you're not invited to attend the seven Moed Mikre with Yahweh, which is the basis for saving his children, for empowering, enriching, and elongating the lives of his children, adopting them. And so if you're involved in the celebration of Christmas and Easter, even if you know they're wrong, even if they're not a huge part of your life, you're still precluding yourself from being able to participate in the covenant and thus being saved. So, Larry, you're right. They're deadly. Let's try Glenn again and the solstice. Hi, Glenn. All right. Well, something's not working technically.
That works. Yeah, I just had a flip again.
You can hear me?
Yeah, hello. Yeah, hi, Glenn.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, okay, good. I didn't change anything on my end at all. It was on that end, or okay. On the network somewhere. No, I was, you heard you talking about Tammuz. I was going to mention the, you know, similarities with Osiris, and then you ended up making passing mention of it. I mean, it's no coincidence that we have the hours of the day, which are the same letters, H-O-U-R, you know, S on the horse, it's H-O-R-U-S. Right. We have the hours of the day, and we turn our lights on, O-N, who is Osiris.
Right.
And, you know, all these things. We have, and you mentioned,
and Christians in their prayers in the name of the, Egyptian god, Amun-Ra.
Right. And then you have the god dying and then rising, you know, being born at the winter solstice. Is the shortest
Osiris.
Day of the year, the shortest, darkest, day of the year. Right. And then the days begin to lengthen again, representing the rebirth of the sun.
Right.
And so with Osiris, you had, Isis putting the body of Horus back together. And the solar cultus is also the phallic cultus. It's the solar phallic cultus. That's why it's the one part of Osiris that Isis couldn't find, and she fabricated to become impregnated. And also, in the daily cycle, you have Horus at the sunrise, Osiris at the noontime, and Set at the so we have the sun set. The three different manifestations, the dark,
That was the Egyptian trinity. Just as it was the Babylonian trinity, this was the Egyptian trinity. Horus was the represented the sun, that was the father of the gods. Isis was the queen of heaven and the mother of God, and Osiris was the son of the sun, who was born on what is essentially now Christmas Day, when the sun's rays begin to lengthen, the days begin to lengthen, and manifest exactly 9 months after the sun, God impregnated Mother Earth, the Egyptian religion would be Isis at that time.
Right.
I mean, it's almost a perfect adaptation of the Babylonian turned Egyptian turned Greek turned Roman religion.
Right. And this carries over into the civil religion too. It's no coincidence that George Washington is the quote father of our country, and representing him is a 666 foot tall phallic symbol, obelisk, in Washington, D.C. He's a sun solar hero integrated into civil religion. And,
nor is it any surprise that the obelisk that sits in the middle of the Vatican, the obelisk that sits next to the Pope's palace there in the Vatican, are emblazoned with the names of Osiris, of Isis, of Horus, of Amun-Ra, and that speak of this very same religious cult, and that the obelisk was designed to reach up like a sun's ray and be the first and the last man-made structure to reflect the sun's rays at the morning and the evening. It was adopted wholesale into Roman Catholicism. We'll be back with Glenn and with Larry after the break. We're chattering this during our conversation here with Larry about the fallacies, the myths associated with Christmas. Larry, let me just begin with this question for you. Is it possible for God to have been born?
No, as a matter of fact, even if you look at the witness writings, you have Yahusha saying, you know, before Abraham, I was. He existed all along. He just became visible to us at the end of the fourth millennia from the fall of Adam. That's all.
Yeah. Think of the hypothetical that God's not infinite in time, that he actually had a birthday, that he was conceived on a certain day. Let's just play the mind game that God was actually conceived on a certain day. Could God have been conceived after he conceived the universe?
No. It would be impossible.
That would be impossible. And was 33 CE, which is year 4000, is 33 CE a little after he conceived the universe?
About 15 billion years later, roughly.
Okay.
That.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's immediately say that God can't have a birthday, so the celebrating God's birthday on Christmas is an absolute ludicrous idea. Does Yahweh's testimony in Scripture, does it ever speak of God being born?
No. No, he lives outside the realm of time.
Yeah.
He associates himself with light, therefore, you know, he's a being of energy. He lives outside the realm of time.
Yeah, outside certainly the constraints of time, certain. I mean, literally, his creation defines time. Without his creation, there is no concept of time. Time only began.
That's right.
when he transitioned some of his energy into matter. Some point, the moment that matter was conceived out of energy through his spoken words, time began to flow. Prior to that time, there's not even a concept of time. Through the prophet Yeshaya, Christians will claim that it says, "Wait a minute, a child is born and a son is given," but it doesn't actually say that at all. It says that a child is born and that a son is given, but the child that's born is not God. I mean, if your God is so small that your God fits into the construct of a human baby, you don't have much of a God, do you?
Yeah, he ends up taking his set apart spirit is set upon, and that's what we're supposed to focus on, the set apart spirit and his spiritual endeavors. I mean, he even tells us in Yasha Yo, that's the way to do it. It isn't the birth, the physical birth, and he said, you know, he's not even going to adjudicate from that angle.
Right. A child was born. A child is not God. But a son is given to us. So the son in Hebrew is the representative, the one who comes in his father's name, the one who's about his father's business, is what the concept of ben son means in Hebrew. And so the son was given to us, which means that Yahweh, through the Spirit, which is the same way we're adopted, by the way, into his family. Our spiritual mother adorns us in a garment of light, and we're spiritually manifest as his children. That exact same technique was used to turn the infant child that was born into the representative of Yahweh, the one who came in his father's name to be about his father's business. So he was made the part of Yahweh manifest in our world the same way that we're manifest spiritually. Same process. But that doesn't mean that God was born. It means a child was born. And by the way, was that the first time that that Yosha visited this planet?
No, because any physical manifestation of Yahweh would be Yahweh saving. It would be Yahusha, and that's
right.
You know, I mean, he was with Adam in the garden, wasn't he?
Right. Well,
he stood on knee with Abraham, didn't he?
He absolutely did. Yeah. So Abraham drank and partied with Abraham, and he manifested himself to the prophet Shamuel. Ate and drank with him, was seen and manifest physically to Shamuel. The fact is, in fact, he wrestled or met there directly with Jacob. It was Satan that he wrestled with, but he met with Jacob. In 33 CE, which was year 4000 Yah, when Yosha fulfilled the first four Mikra, that was actually the conclusion of his sixth visit to planet Earth. Sixth. And he's going to have a seventh. The seventh is Yahweh's return. And the seventh will be different than the previous six. And then the seventh, he's coming very slightly dialed down. He's going to return his light, which is why all those that aren't already born anew from above in the set apart spirit will be incinerated at that time. Now, beyond the fact that God cannot be born, and that the totality of God cannot be manifest in a male child, much less a human being. That makes your God pretty small. As we move through this whole myth, isn't there a specific time on Yahweh's calendar when he camps out with us?
Yeah, there sure is, because he says he fulfills his Mikra. And
right.
So he literally acts to save the family on set-apart days.
Right.
We have a fulfillment of the first four spring Moed Mikra.
Mm-hmm.
And then Teruah is the few trumpets, the people who are actually trumpeting Yahweh's words and getting them out there for people to hear and condemning the world for what it is, because that's exactly what the prophets did.
Mm-hmm.
You're throwing out Yahweh's words. You're trumpeting them. Those people are going to be removed pre-tribulation.
Right.
And then what you've got in the fulfillment of the next Moed Mikra is Kippurim, which means reconciliations, the awesome day, the day of his return. And on that day, the family is reconciled, which is what Kippurim means. 5 days later, everybody's walking into Jerusalem to Sukkah.
Right.
To start
right,
that 1,000-year millennial
that
period.
The covenant is renewed is when he returns on Yom Kippur.
On Kippur.
But Sukkah is the day of camping out. So he's going to return on Yom Kippur and going to start camping out with his creation beginning on Sukkah. So since most all of the Moed Mikra, the seven invitations to meet with God, since most all of them had a dress rehearsal, something symbolic in human history that helps illuminate the meaning and purpose. For example, while Yosha fulfilled Pesach as the Passover lamb, there are two dress rehearsals through two previews of Pesach and what it represents prior to Yosha fulfilling it in year 4,000.
Yeah, just to try to drill it into our heads.
Yeah, you know what those two
one
are?
One leaving Egypt, that would be one.
Egypt, which tells us that it's about prolonging life, that it is associated with the firstborn son's prolonging life. That's a pretty good clue. But there was one before that.
Well, yeah, sure. You had Abraham.
440
on
years.
On Mount Moriah, on that very spot where mm-hmm. Yahweh told him what? He said, I'll provide the lamb.
Yeah. Don't take your son. I will provide the lamb. And there with head stuck in the thorns in the thicket was the lamb that Yahweh provided. This act that was taking place, this meeting that was taking place on Mount Moriah with Abraham Yishak, which means laughter, his son, and with Yahweh and the lamb that Yahweh provided, wasn't that the affirmation of the covenant?
Sure was.
Wasn't the whole concept of this the covenant? And so, with Yahweh providing the sacrificial lamb on Mount Moriah in association with the covenant, wouldn't we be wise to associate the fulfillment of Pesach with the covenant?
Yes, we would. That would right. be the point, in fact, of the whole thing.
And since Yishak was a beneficiary of the covenant by Yahweh's own testimony, shouldn't we then look at the sparing of Yishak's life by the lamb that Yahweh provided as another indication that Passover is about preserving the life of the children of the covenant?
Yes.
Right. I mean, he's trying to convey a message. You just got to think about it, put it in context, saying what is being conveyed here. So you've got two dress rehearsals for Pesach Passover. For Matzah, you have the dress rehearsal of leaving Egypt. Now, why would there be the first dress rehearsal of matzah, do you think? And we're going to get to Sukkah, so we understand that there was a dress rehearsal for Sukkah, too, which is the time that Yosha arrived as the child. With the matzah, do you have any idea as to why the first matzah is celebrated leaving, the day that they left Egypt.
Yeah, because you're walking away from, they were walking away from slavery, religion, mm-hmm. and becoming perfected by walking right. towards Yahweh. So
yeah, this whole integration of religion and politics and man pretending to be divine and an economic scheme based upon enslaving others and the mightiest military on the planet at that time, they were walking away from Egypt that represented the worst of humanity. And that's what they were leaving behind. And so it's symbolic of when we celebrate unyeasted bread, where the fungus of yeast representing all the things they were walking away from is what we have removed from us during the actual fulfillment of matzah. So that's the dress rehearsal. It explains its purpose. Distancing yourself from human corruptions. And then the actual celebration of matzah was by Yosha in 33 CE. And Larry, when we return, I'll have you explain to our listeners what happened on matzah, on unyeasted bread, in year 4000, 33 CE, that ties in with the illustration that was provided during the Exodus. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering This. We had a lingering question at the end of the last segment. I was asked, Larry, how Yosha, in year 4000, 33 CE, went about fulfilling the promise that Yahweh made regarding the purpose and benefit of matzah.
Well, let's go right to Yasha Yahu. Okay. And what's happened here is that a man died
right.
on an upright
body.
State.
The physical body.
And then his soul enters Sheol. And here's what it says. When as a concession, mm-hmm. he shall render his soul, nephesh, as a guilt offering. Out of the toil of his soul, he will see the light and find satisfaction. And through knowing, in a relational sense, which is what yada means,
mm-hmm.
the one who vindicates my servant, many will be vindicated as he will bear their guilt and punishment. So he takes on the punishment in Sheol.
Right.
He also took the strokes due to the family. Not all men who believe, but he took the strokes that were due to, quote, the family. So now his soul is in Sheol, and it's acting as a ransom to vindicate family members.
Let's go one step further. That same passage in Yashaya speaks of the sacrificial lamb. The sacrificial lamb, when it is sacrificed, is it to the body of the lamb that's sacrificed, or does someone try to kill its soul? If you're gonna celebrate Passover, are you barbecuing the soul of the lamb or the body of the lamb?
It's the body.
The body
that you're barbecuing.
Right. Yeah. You're barbecuing. And so was it the body or the soul of Yahusha that was sacrificed on Passover?
It was the body.
Yeah, just the body. And what does the Torah say about the portion of that body that remains on the evening of Pesach? What does it say?
It's
that
to be burnt up entirely in the fire. That's what
right.
it says.
Yes. So does the body of the lambs survive?
No.
No. Would it be possible for the body of the lamb, therefore, to be resurrected?
No. And it wasn't.
No.
Now, his soul, we saw right there, his soul sees the light and finds satisfaction. So his nephesh, or soul, actually escapes Sheol. And then what happens is that it meets back up with the set-apart spirit, and he goes out and meets again with his disciples, and none of them recognize him. They've been walking with him 3 years. They don't even know who he is.
Yeah, completely new creation. I would ask you, Larry, When Yosha served as the Passover lamb on the upright pole, was at that moment, was before he sacrificed his body, was he the totality of God?
No, not at all.
Was he God at all when the Spirit left him, when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?
No, he wasn't.
Right. And when he was, when he quoted that line, my God, why have you forsaken me? Was he asking a question, or was he pointing us to something that would provide some guidance as to what was happening there?
Well, no, he pointed us to guidance, because this is kind of unusual too, because you see that in Psalms, or the Mizmor 22:1, the song,
right.
It says,
right.
Elohim anymore. My El, why have you forsaken me? That's the singular of Mighty One.
Right. And the forsaken there is
now
the Hebrew word
in a singular form. Yeah, he's saying, why have you forsaken me? And in the very next verse, it says, far away from Yahusha, my salvation, are the words of my, are the words of my groaning, oh my Elohim. So now it's plural again.
Right.
So what's happened is the set apart spirit has went back to Yahweh, this manifestation of Yahweh.
Right.
So now it's the plural of El. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's all explained in the 22nd Psalm, which is why he quoted the opening line of the 22nd Psalm, so we would understand specifically what was happening there. By far the best, most complete, most accurate eyewitness account of what was occurring is presented in Psalm 22, Psalm 88, and Yashaya 53. It's too bad so few people consider what God directed us to know.